It's 7:30 on this West Virginia morning. I'm Ashton Mara. When science meets cultural history meets a pretty horrible smell, what do you get? Salt rising bread, an Appalachian tradition.
Salt rising bread requires that you're home all day. You literally cannot leave your house because you have to be so careful to watch each stage and be there when it's ready.
The ingenuity of pioneer women and how they persevered with their cooking, coming up on West Virginia Morning. The balance of power built into our state's framework more than 150 years ago is a delicate one, to say the least. Any fourth grade West Virginia history student can name the three branches of government and tell you what they're called to do. But what happens to that power when politics or politicians get involved? This story, however, is not one of competing politics. Instead, this is the story of how similar politics may be causing one branch to give their powers to another. At least, that's how one lawmaker sees it. In our strong executive form of government, the balance of power seems to tip in favor of the office of governor. He or she oversees state agencies, sets the budget, approves or vetoes bills. The list continues. Former Governor Bob Wise says that wide power is necessary in a small state with a non-professional, part-time legislature. Someone needs to be there to lead in times of crisis. Someone who also has the powers that allow him or her to act. But House Minority Leader Tim Armstead says the governor's office is gaining more and more power over time, and not because that's how it's written in the Constitution.
I think the legislature's kind of ceded some of its power to the governor and kind of deferred a little too much to the governor. And I'm not sure that that's necessarily a factor of what the Constitution gives the governor in terms of power, but just how much we've kind of given up power and authority of the legislature to the governor, almost voluntarily in a lot of ways.
Armstead believes the legislature is essentially giving some of its authority to the governor because typically he and legislative leaders are from the same political party. He says they defer to him when it comes to policy stances and budget priorities.
And a lot of it, I think, has been a factor of, you know, the same party being in control in both those, and they don't want to stand up to the governor in that sense.
Wise sees other areas where the strength of the legislature is slipping, like the power to override a veto. That constitutional power has been in question in recent weeks because of a lack of clarity.
They absolutely do have the right to override if they get their work done on time.
In the press, even here at West Virginia Public Radio, there is continuous coverage of the chaos of the final night of the legislative session. The last-minute debates and compromises, the votes that get squeezed in right before midnight. The whole thing can be exciting and exhausting, but Wise says it doesn't have to be that way. Now, this is where it gets complicated, but bear with me. This is important. For an explanation, we go back to the Constitution. Article 6 sets out legislative powers and says after a bill is passed, the governor has 5 days to consider the bill. If he chooses to veto the legislation, it returns to its originating chamber, where 2/3 of the member can vote to override that veto. It then goes to the opposite house for the same vote, and if both houses agree, the veto is overridden. But that's only when the legislature is still in session. If lawmakers adjourn sine die as they do at the end of each budget session, the governor has 15 days to approve or reject a bill. But there's no mention in the article of how to override that decision then. Essentially, Wise believes by waiting until the final night to pass a majority of the bills, as lawmakers often do, the legislature is giving up their constitutional power to override a veto.
The governor's veto power is not unique. I mean, every governor has some veto power, and the president of the United States. What really needs to be looked at then, to me, is does the legislature have the tools it needs in order to be able to perform its functions in a timely manner, in a quality manner, and is the legislature acting in a timely fashion?
Wise maintains lawmakers are working on bills throughout the interim sessions, and often they are pieces of legislation that aren't coming up for the first time. There are typically a large number of bills being reconsidered that didn't pass in previous sessions and are reworked during the legislative process.
What is critical, though, in this balance of power is, yes, the governor should be the strong executive, but the legislature should make sure that the legislature has the tools that it needs in staff, in materials, whatever it needs, in order to perform its functions, too. When both are able to function at their maximum productivity and effectiveness, then we get the best government.
Armstead says even if lawmakers were able to more evenly spread out the passage of bills and get more through before the final night, you'd still have those pieces of legislation that aren't passed until the end, whether because they're complex, they're political, or just because of timing. One arena the governor holds a majority of the authority in is setting the budget. His office sets the revenue estimates for the fiscal year, giving the legislature a parameter to work within. His office creates its own budget, setting the policy priorities for funding, which the legislature can change. But the governor can ultimately go back in and strike out or change any amount by exercising a line item veto. That's what we saw last month when Tomlin was criticized for slashing $67 million from family and senior services. Gubernatorial budget powers were expanded in 1968 with the passage of a constitutional amendment benefiting then-Republican Governor Arch Moore. His modern budget amendment meant for the first time the governor and his staff would fully prepare the proposed budget, as opposed to the governor and the Board of Public Works coming to an agreement on spending. The amendment at the time was ratified by the people of the state, but that's after the legislature approved it. Giving away more of their influence? It's debatable. Ted Bettner, executive director for the West Virginia Center on Budget and Policy, said in an interview in January, the governor's powers in the budget realm should be dispersed more evenly with the legislature. He says that makes the process more democratic and more transparent. But Senate Finance Chairman Roman Prezioso says the governor's office needs to have that power.
The governor is the CEO. It's no different from any big business or corporation where you have an individual that's the head of the company. It's that person's responsibility to set the parameters and the guidelines for their particular industry, and it's no different for the governor setting the parameters and guidelines for the state of West Virginia. Somebody has to do it. He is bound to work with the agencies to determine their best function and efficiency, and then present that budget to us.
Wise says the line item veto, which he estimates he exercised twice in his tenure, is also a check on lawmakers who may stray from the bigger picture.
What it also does is it permits the governor to remove some spending that might look good to an individual legislator, but not so good for the overall budget, or perhaps is what some people might call pork.
The constitutional requirement to balance the budget also falls on the shoulders of the governor, Wise says. And in tough economic times, when the legislature isn't around, the executive needs to be able to make decisions to balance the budget. Tomorrow on West Virginia Morning, we take a closer look at the debate over the vetoed abortion bill and the constitutional questions surrounding a possible override vote of the legislature. You're listening to Morning Edition, West Virginia Morning on West Virginia Public Radio. It's 7:38. A freeze warning remains in effect until 9 this morning for western and central portions of the state. Sunny today with highs in the 50s and 60s, overnight lows in the 30s.
Support for West Virginia Public Radio is provided by the West Virginia Humanities Council, publishers of EWV, West Virginia's online encyclopedia, All There Is to Know About West Virginia, WVEncyclopedia.org.
Coming up next, it's a story of longing and memories, sweet smells and horrible rank, and also of pathogens and solar pioneer cooking. This is a story about a fading Appalachian tradition that two bakers are working hard to preserve. Glennis Board reports.
Salt rising bread is an Appalachian traditional bread made without yeast. It's a baking custom that can be traced back to the 1800s, but not much has been documented about the bread or its history. So two women in Mount Morris, Pennsylvania, began a quest to understand the hows and whys behind a tradition that seems to captivate anyone who catches wind of it. Bakers Jenny Bardwell and Susan Brown have been researching the bread for 20 years.
We often describe salt rising bread as dense white bread with a fine crumb and a unique cheese-like flavor. Indeed, it is, when at its best, as if a delicately reared, unsweetened plain cake had had an affair with a Pont-l'Evêque cheese.
Susan Brown quotes James Furness, who describes salt rising bread in his book, The Americans.
So in other words, fancy combination of a fancy French cheese and a plain sweet cake, and you get that sweet cheese-like savory flavor of salt rising bread.
Brown grew up in Greenbrier County, where every Saturday she would have salt rising toast and eggs for breakfast with her grandmother. She's passionate about passing down the tradition. Brown's friend, Jenny Bardwell, was introduced to the custom through a neighbor, the recently deceased Pearl Haynes of Mount Morris, who made the bread for 90 years.
I'd go visit her, and they were making this bread that I'd never heard of, and it was a very unique bread. There's no yeast in it. So I immediately latched on to, this is special. I never learned about anything like that in cooking school.
Through surveying their customers, Bardwell and Brown have discovered that by far, the favorite way to eat the bread is toasted with butter. Others like it dipped in sweet coffee or toasted with milk and brown sugar on top. The history of salt rising bread is something of a mystery. Passed down as an oral tradition, there are few records that hint at its origin. Brown and Bardwell have done some serious research, though. They've even traveled to bakeries abroad looking for connections. While it's difficult to draw any definite conclusions, their best guess is that the tradition was born of necessity in remote and isolated Appalachian regions in the late 1700s. Bardwell says the bread is a testament to the spirit of the female pioneer.
What we're finding out really is the ingenuity of pioneer women and how they persevered with their cooking. They were isolated. Appalachian women were isolated. They weren't able to get commercial yeast. It wasn't even produced till the 1860s, but they wanted a loaf of bread, so they kind of, anyway, they persevered with this very difficult bread to make.
We also believe that it's possible that these pioneer women would leave flour and water mixed together, like from maybe a gravy or a cream sauce that they were putting on something, and realized that if it was set overnight, it would bubble in the morning and their bread would rise from that.
Even the name, salt rising bread, is a little mysterious. Brown says it's really a misnomer because recipes call for very little salt. She says one possible explanation might have something to do with a wagon wheel.
We do have documentation of the pioneer women who crossed the country on the pioneer trails keeping their starters warm in the salt barrel, which was kept on top of the wagon wheel. And as they traveled across the country during the day, the sun would warm the salt, which would in turn warm the starter.
Wow.
And then they could make their bread in the evening when they stopped traveling.
Bardwell explains that heat is a critical ingredient in dough making.
It's a very difficult bread to make. Primarily the main difference between salt rising bread and sourdough, which is wild yeast, salt rising bread is primarily wild bacteria that you're culturing with heat. Sourdough happens at room temperature. Salt rising bread happens from about 105 to 115 degrees Fahrenheit.
Bardwell says there are three phases of salt rising bread. You got to make a starter dough, then grow it, then bake it. Simple, right? You make your starter with potatoes and water and heat, or milk and cornmeal and heat. I know, very different, right? And yet, they create the same product. Riddle me that. Then you wait and watch.
And it's variable since you're capturing wild bacteria. Sometimes it's 9 hours, sometimes it's 11 hours, and you have to be really tuned into this bread. You have to kind of know how to recognize it when it's ready, not before, not an hour later. You have to kind of know. Then you make it into a sponge stage, so you're kind of increasing this batch of microbes.
Bardwell says depending on which recipe you use, the starters look very different.
One's with milk, one's with potatoes and water. They look very different, and they smell differently. That is another big characteristic of salt rising bread, is it smells strong. I kind of like the smell. Some people can't stand it.
Barnwell says she met one centenarian from North Central West Virginia who remembers that smell from her childhood. The old woman said she knew to avoid the neighbors when she could smell the dough because the missus only made it when she was really angry with her husband, who hated the smell. So what makes it stink is what makes it rise. This is where the baker meets the candlestick maker. Brown and Bardwell put their science caps on and headed to a lab in Pittsburgh.
In just our own quest to find out what is this microbe that's rising the bread that lends this wonderful flavor, we had it isolated, and we took like a dozen starters up to this scientist in University of Pittsburgh. He was very nice to entertain us with this whole quest. And we walk in and it smells just like salt rising bread.
So this guy, Bruce McLean, has made a name for himself as a pathologist. And he studies Clostridium perfringens, one of the wild microbes responsible for the rising in the salt rising bread. The women explain that they came to learn that these microbes can be pathogenic. They can cause, get ready for it, gangrene in human beings, or enteritis. That's diarrhea. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Nobody's gotten sick from eating salt rising bread. As a matter of fact, we've written an article with a physician at WVU, Dr. Greg Juckett, who loves salt rising bread, and there is absolutely no history of anyone ever getting sick eating salt rising bread.
Bardwell and Brown explain that the pathologist, Bruce McLean, was asked to write an article for the West Virginia Medical Journal.
He doesn't know anything about salt rising bread, so we wrote it.
Remember when I mentioned that Brown and Bardwell have gone so far as to visit bakeries abroad looking for the origin of salt rising bread? Well, they didn't find it. But they did find a couple of very similar yeastless breads. In Greece, there's a recipe that calls for chickpeas. In the Sudan, there's a recipe that uses lentils.
And we found that there are these scientific studies in Turkey and Greece and Sudan on these similar breads, and they've studied them extensively. They say have the same results. There's no pathogenic toxin to be found.
Brown explains that it turns out Clostridium perfringens and some other bacteria are ubiquitous. They're found all through nature, on the potatoes, in the flour, in the cornmeal. Somehow, Bardwell suspects a symbiotic relationship between all of these bacteria raise the bread and give it flavor and texture. But the fact that it doesn't make anyone sick is still kind of a mystery. Another mystery. By the by, Bardwell and Brown really want to find someone who is interested in researching the bread and the wild microbes. They say they're willing participants. Their quest to understand this bread continues, even as the tradition seems to be facing extinction. Brown says there are a couple of reasons it's fallen from fashion. She says the elder keepers of the oral tradition are dying, along with their way of life.
Salt rising bread requires that you're home all day. You literally cannot leave your house because you have to be so careful to watch each stage and be there when it's ready.
But for now, Bardwell and Brown and at least a few others throughout Appalachia are still nurturing the wild microbial bread. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Glynis Board in Mount Morris.
You can learn more about salt rising bread and hear some heartwarming stories of shared memories of the custom if you visit our website, wvpublic.org. West Virginia Morning is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, which is solely responsible for its content. You can listen to and read news stories on our website at wvpublic.org. Support for West Virginia Public Broadcasting's news bureaus comes from Shepherd University, West Virginia University, Marshall University, and Concord University. Our producer is Beneduccio. Our news director is Beth Voorhees. Our director is Teresa Wills. I'm Ashton Mara.